content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I begin today with an article from the Annals of Religion section of the April 3rd, 2023 issue of the New Yorker magazine. How Christian is Christian nationalism? Many Americans who advocate it have little interest in religion and an aversion to American culture as it currently exists. What really defines the movement? By Khalifa Sane. 7 years ago, during the Republican presidential primary, Donald Trump appeared on stage at Dort University, a Christian institution in Iowa, and made a confession of faith. "I'm a true believer," he said, and he conducted an impromptu poll. "Is everybody a true believer in this room?" He was scarcely the first presidential candidate to make a religious appeal, but he might have been the first one to address Christian voters so explicitly as a special interest. "You have the strongest lobby ever," he said, "but I never hear about a Christian lobby." He made his audience a promise. "If I'm there, you're going to have plenty of power," he said. "You're going to have somebody representing you very, very well." By the time Trump reluctantly left office in 2021, his relationship with evangelical Christians was one of the most powerful alliances in American politics. According to one survey, he won 84% of the white evangelical vote in 2020. On January 6th, when his supporters gathered in Washington to protest the election results, one person brought along a placard depicting Jesus wearing a MAGA hat. During the Capitol invasion, a shirtless protester delivered a prayer on the Senate floor. "Thank you for filling this chamber with patriots that love you and that love Christ," he said. The events of January 6 bolstered a growing belief that the alliance between Trump and his Christian supporters had become something more like a movement, a pro-Trump uprising with a distinctive ideology. This ideology is sometimes called Christian nationalism, a description that often functions as a diagnosis. On a recent episode of RevCovery, a podcast about leaving Christian ministry, Justin Gentry, one of the hosts, suggested that the belief system was somewhat obscure, even to its own adherents. "I think that spitballing 70% of Christian nationalists don't know that they're Christian nationalists," he said. "They're just like this is normal Christianity from the time of Jesus." In contemporary America, though, the practice of Christianity is starting to seem abnormal. Measures of religious observance in America have shown a steep decrease over the past quarter century. In 1999, Gallup found that 70% of Americans belonged to a church, a synagogue, or a mosque. In 2020, the number was 47%. For the first time in nearly 100 years of polling, worshipers were the minority. This changing environment helps explain the militance that is one of the defining features of Christian nationalism. It is a minority movement, espousing a claim that might not have seemed terribly controversial a few decades ago, that America is and should remain a Christian nation. There is no canonical manifesto of Christian nationalism and no single definition of it. In search of rigor, a pair of sociologists, Andrew L. Whitehead and Samuel L. Perry, examined data from various surveys and tracked the replies to six propositions. 1. The federal government should declare the United States a Christian nation. 2. The federal government should advocate Christian values. 3. The federal government should enforce strict separation of church and state. 4. The federal government should allow the display of religious symbols in public spaces. 5. The success of the United States is part of God's plan. 6. The federal government should allow prayer in public schools. Respondents who answered more in the affirmative or, in the case of the third proposition, the negative, were judged to be more supportive of Christian nationalism, and the scholars conducted interviews with 50 subjects to get a better sense of who believed what. Near the end of Trump's term, Whitehead and Perry published the results in a book called Taking America Back for God, in which they predicted a growing schism. Christian nationalism gives divine sanction to ethnocentrism and nativism, they wrote, noting that a number of respondents doubted that immigrants or non-English speakers could ever be truly American. Christian nationalism was, they argued, a divisive creed. Its adherents were more likely than other groups to believe that Muslims and atheists hold morally inferior values. Perry expanded this argument last year in The Flag and the Cross, which he wrote with the sociologist Philip S. Gorski. For many people, Gorski and Perry argue Christian refers less to theology than to heritage. Drawing on their own survey, they found that more than a fifth of respondents who wanted the government to declare the U.S. a Christian nation also described themselves as being secular or an adherent of a non-Christian faith. Paradoxically, so did more than 15% of self-identified Christians. The last data point might be a sign that Christian is starting to become something more like Jewish, an ancestral identity that you can keep, even if you don't keep the faith. There are, of course, plenty of non-white Christians in America and even non-white Christian nationalists. In the earlier book, Whitehead and Perry reported that black Americans were, in fact, more likely than any other racial group to support Christian nationalism. But Gorski and Perry argue that in American politics, Christian nationalism has often served as a white identity movement. They note, for instance, that white Americans who support Christian nationalism are likelier to evince disapproval of immigration and concern about anti-white discrimination. And they worry that white Christian nationalism is working just beneath the surface of American politics, ready to trigger an outburst, as it did on January 6th. There will be another eruption, and soon, they write. Gorski and Perry warn that a second Trump administration might lead to Jim Crow 2.0, with non-white undocumented immigrants singled out for mass deportations on an unprecedented scale. But they also note that the white Christian nationalists in their survey express the most hostility not toward immigrants or toward Muslims, but toward socialists. In this, the Christian nationalists are firmly within the historical mainstream of American conservatism. That may also be true even of those respondents who wish to institutionalize Christian identity and values in the public square, given all the ways in which America remains distinctively and sometimes officially Christian. The federal government shuts down on Christmas, for instance, and no other religious holiday. Even in New York, there are no special restrictions on the sale of alcohol on Sunday, the Christian Sabbath. An allegedly insurgent demand is, in a way, a description of the status quo. As a whole, the six Christian nationalist propositions appear to be correlated with all sorts of other ideas and impulses. But examined individually, most of them aren't hard to defend. School prayer has been the subject of a series of fine-grained Supreme Court decisions. This past summer, the court ruled 6-3 in favor of a high school football coach who liked to pray on the field after games. As for whether it is God's plan that the United States succeed, even someone with nuanced views about providence and predestination might nevertheless hope so. To a secular liberal, it might seem distasteful for a Christian to consider Muslim or atheistic values morally inferior, or to want the government to promote Christian values. But to claim any set of values as your own is to find them superior in some meaningful sense to the alternatives and probably to hope that they will guide the decisions that your government makes on your behalf. In any case, it is impossible to separate the Christian history of America from the country we live in today. Both the secularization of the country and the counter-reaction to that secularization are reflections, in different ways, of a country founded on ideals of faith and freedom. Anyone looking for a charter of American Christian nationalism might begin in 1630, the year John Winthrop, the future governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, delivered his speech comparing the settlement to a city upon a hill in covenant with God, serving as a beacon to all people. The famous phrase came from Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. Ye are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hid. In the 18th century, arguments for American independence were often cast in religious terms. Congregationalists, who structured their churches around ideals of self-governance and free conscience, were particularly influential. Jonathan Mayhew, a congregational minister in Boston, published a sermon in 1750 in which he denounced the tyranny and oppression of Charles I, the former king. One of Charles's transgressions, he authorized a book in favor of sports upon the Lord's Day. On this front, anyway, America is indisputably less Christian than it used to be. And in November 1777, the Continental Congress issued a message of wartime commemoration and gratitude. It is sometimes considered the first Thanksgiving proclamation, which extolled the principles of true liberty, virtue, and piety. There is a certain tension, of course, between the principle of liberty and that of piety. In 1791, the First Amendment to the Constitution prohibited the establishment of religion by the new federal government, but Massachusetts did not officially break with the Congregational Church until 1833. Then, as now, Christian identity in America was often tribal, which is to say anti-tribal. In a fascinating book called Heathen, the religious historian Catherine Jen Lum suggests that in many times and places, the divide between Christian and heathen was the central divide in American life. The original British colonies were sometimes taken to be efforts to promote the propagation of the gospel of Jesus Christ amongst those poor heathen, as a 1649 Act of Parliament declared. The term could justify both exclusion and engagement. The scourge of heathenism was later adduced as a reason to oppose Chinese immigration to California and to support the annexation of the Hawaiian Islands. But heathen is an unstable identity because it denotes a condition that ought to be cured. A heathen is someone who has not yet been exposed to and converted to Christianity. Africans and their descendants were sometimes held to be heathens of a peculiar sort because they were considered to be both a biblical people and a cursed one. Descendants of Canaan, the son of Ham and the grandson of Noah. In the Bible, Ham has an ambiguous encounter with a drunk and a naked Noah and is punished with a generational affliction. Cursed be Canaan. A servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren. Frederick Douglass, in his autobiography, described this view of Africans as a perversion of the Bible. He wrote that he abhorred what he called the religion of the South, but also that he cherished the pure, peaceable, and impartial Christianity of Christ. He was making a version of an argument that appears throughout American history, that this country is not truly Christian enough. Across the centuries, the political power of Christianity has waxed and waned, in tandem with waves of religious revival and retreat, and with the needs and aspirations of politicians. In 1899, a newly elected U.S. Senator, Albert J. Beveridge, endorsed the conquest of the Philippines in starkly missionary terms, declaring, "It is ours to bear the torch of Christianity where midnight has reigned 1,000 years." Judging from church membership figures, the 1950s may have been the most pious period in American history. It was the decade when the phrase, "under God," was added to the Pledge of Allegiance, 1954, and when "In God We Trust" was adopted as the country's official motto, 1956. By then, politicians were talking less about heathenism and more about a new adversary. Many, like Senator Joseph McCarthy, believed that America was engaged in a final all-out battle between communistic atheism and Christianity. In America, Christianity works best as an organizing principle when there is a strong non-Christian force to organize against. In The Religion of American Greatness, What's Wrong with Christian Nationalism, Paul D. Miller, a political scientist at Georgetown, tries to make sense of this complicated history. He is, he writes, a Christian and a patriot, proudly pro-life and a zealot for religious liberty. Yet, he thinks there is a difference between leaders who humbly seek God's guidance and those who insist, as Jerry Falwell once did, that, quote, when a nation's ways please the Lord, that nation is blessed with supernatural help, end quote. Miller wants Christians to be more aware of the undemocratic elements of the founding and more willing to consider the possibility that America's history since then has been, in some ways, a gradual story of progress. In place of Christian nationalism, he advocates something more abstract, an acknowledgement that Anglo-Protestant culture has shaped America's ideals, and a hope that those ideals will endure even as culture changes. In the face of all this disapproval, a few intellectuals have decided to claim the term for themselves. In The Case for Christian Nationalism, Stephen Wolfe, a political philosopher and faithful Presbyterian, advances a series of syllogisms designed to convince believers that they must help America become more Christian and more of a nation. But the country he wants to bring about seems less a realistic future for America than a thought experiment, occasionally a sinister one. Wolfe's Protestant vision sometimes evokes the Catholic integralists who dream of building an unapologetically Catholic state. He has firm opinions on whether non-Christians are entitled to political equality, no, whether political atheism should be excluded from the bounds of acceptable opinion, yes, and whether arch-heretics can justifiably be put to death. Yes. In Wolfe's view, Christians are too quick to dismiss the virtue of tribalism, the notion that people are drawn to others who share their ethnicity, a word he uses to gesture at a wide range of traits. Ethnicity, as he defines it, is not just blood ties, but also language, manners, customs, stories, taboos, rituals, calendars, social expectations, duties, loves, and religion. At one point, Wolfe disparages ethnic identity politics, but elsewhere he suggests that in some cases, amicable ethnic separation along political lines might be beneficial for everyone. Wolfe's book avoids explicit claims about race, but after its publication in November, a shadow was cast over it by an investigation that Alistair Roberts, an English theologian, conducted into the public writing of one of Wolfe's close friends and collaborators, Thomas Accord. Accord hosted a podcast with Wolfe. Roberts assembled evidence that Accord, under a pseudonym, has been posting online in support of what he called robust race realist white nationalism. Roberts pointed to a Twitter account that had responded to a post from the American Jewish Committee by writing, "Okay, Jew," and referred to Representative Cori Bush of Missouri as a NGRESS. In response to a discussion of white supremacy by Jamar Tisby, a prominent black historian of Christianity, the account posted, quote, "Please leave soon. Sincerely, all white peoples," end quote. Accord parted ways with a Christian school in Louisiana where he had been headmaster and said that the posts, most of them from 2020 or 2021, reflected, quote, "a spiritually dark time marked by pessimism and anger and strained relationships," end quote. While he eventually admitted that the Twitter account in question was his, he said he had trouble recollecting posts connected to it. Accord could not be reached for a comment. Wolfe, who had defended Accord and had pledged some of his book royalties to him, wrote a Twitter thread repudiating the old tweets and asking that his book be judged on its own merits. But the Accord affair made it clear that even a sympathetic reader of Wolfe's book could be confused about how, exactly, an ideology of, quote, amicable ethnic separation, end quote, might differ from white nationalism. The scandal was a big deal in the small world of intellectual Christian nationalism. One difference between Wolfe and someone like Jerry Falwell, who believed many of the same things, is that Falwell could plausibly claim to be leading what he called a moral majority, whereas many of today's Christian nationalists are keenly aware of their minority status and perhaps, as a consequence, less likely to worry about transgressing dominant social norms. In today's America, anyone eager to denounce sodomy is marking himself as a dissident, not a defender of American culture as it currently exists, but rather an enemy of it. Christian nationalists, as sociologists and pundits use the term, refers to a broad array of conservatives concerned, as conservatives always are, about the way their country is changing. But those who embrace the term are a much smaller, self-selected group. In this climate, calling yourself a Christian nationalist is a much more radical act than merely being one. The presidency of George W. Bush was a high-water mark for Christian politics. Bush launched initiatives to support faith-based organizations and brought a missionary's fervor to the promotion of democracy in the Middle East and, much more successfully, AIDS treatment in Africa. By contrast, Trump was perhaps the least Christian president in modern times. Although he kept his promise to anti-abortion Christian voters by appointing three Supreme Court justices who helped overturn Roe v. Wade, he seemed to view this not as a moral triumph, but as a favor for a special interest. During a recent interview, Trump said, "They won, Roe v. Wade, they won." In this formulation, "they" meant the Christian lobby, and Trump expressed disappointment that they hadn't done more to support his preferred candidates during the 2022 midterms. And though some of Trump's supporters put Christian identity front and center, others are harder to categorize. The January 6th protester who prayed in the Senate, for instance, was Jake Angeli, known as the QAnon Shaman, who had previously referred to himself as part of a light occultic force. During his prayer, Angeli thanked God for the divine, omnipresent white light of love and protection, peace and harmony. This is the language of light workers and of other contemporary spiritualists. Perhaps a shaman is the perfect figurehead for a movement defined by Christian heritage, not Christian faith. America may now be following the trajectory of Europe, where Viktor Orban, the Prime Minister of Hungary, talks about the importance of Christian roots, even though fewer than 20% of Hungarians attend church regularly. If the rise of Christian nationalism in America reflects the decline of Christianity, that is bittersweet news for secular liberals, because it means that they might expect to see more and more of it as the country grows less pious. How did this decline happen? No one seems to know. Sociologists such as Gorski and Perry can tell us that Christian nationalist beliefs reflect a tribal or partisan identity, but they can't tell us why so many self-identified Christians seem uninterested in the religion itself. Miller, for his part, seems confident that the Christian values he cherishes can endure and thrive, even in an increasingly post-Christian country, but it's not clear why. The question is even more urgent for someone like Wolf, who portrays America as a formerly Christian polity undermined by immigration and relativism. If America was once better than it is now, why did our Christian forebears allow it to get worse? In answering this question, Wolf sometimes sounds more like a critic of the faith than a defender of it. Christian majorities, he contends, too often refuse to wield government power when they have it, insisting on official neutrality in ways that Muslim majorities, for instance, typically don't. Western Christians gaze at the ravishment of their Western heritage, he writes, either blaming themselves or, even worse, reveling in their humiliation. He could almost be quoting Nietzsche, who excoriated Christianity for its ethic of mercy and self-sacrifice, for siding with the weak, the low, the botched. Wolf thinks that there is something weird about the way in which the U.S. and other Western nations reject ethnic chauvinism, officially anyway, in favor of an ideology of universality. But this weird universality is part of what sets Christianity apart from most other creeds. Tellingly, one of the scholars who blurbed Wolf's book was the Israeli political scientist Yoram Hazani, who has suggested that American nationalists should draw inspiration from the example of Israel, which conceives it of itself as the national state of a particular people. The strangest thing about the debate over Christian nationalism is the assumption shared by many of the participants. The sociologists see a fearful tribe, resentful of a country that won't stop changing. Exponents see a small but indomitable new movement, standing strong against a tide of secularism. Miller sees an opportunity for Christians to play a constructive role in a changing country, preaching what their compatriots may no longer practice. But the underlying idea is that recent trends will continue, that churches will keep emptying out, and that Christianity will become an ever more tribal identity. The secular country that emerges might be increasingly free, anxious, and unpredictable. Less prayer in schools, more shamans in the capital. Why should we assume, though, that these trends are irreversible and that most of today's Americans are beyond the reach of a message that has reached so many for so long? Earlier periods of secularization in America have given way to periods of Christian renewal. Is the next Christian revival just around the corner? It seems hard to believe, but surely not impossible. Next, from the A Critic at Large section of the May 24, 2010 issue of the New Yorker magazine, what did Jesus do? Reading and Unreading the Gospels by Adam Gopnik. When we meet Jesus of Nazareth at the beginning of the Gospel of Mark, almost surely the oldest of the four, he's a full-grown man. He comes down from Galilee, meets John, an ascetic desert hermit who lives on locusts and wild honey, and is baptized by him in the River Jordan. If one thing seems nearly certain to the people who read and study the Gospels for a living, it's that this really happened. John the Baptizer, as some like to call him, to give a better sense of the original Greek's flat-footed active form, baptized Jesus. They believe it because it seems so unlikely, so at odds with the idea that Jesus always played the star in his own show. Why would anyone have said it if it weren't true? This curious criterion governs historical criticism of gospel texts. The more improbable or difficult an episode or remark is, the likelier it is to be a true record, on the assumption that you would edit out all the weird stuff if you could, and keep it in only because the tradition is so strong that it can't plausibly be excluded. If Jesus says something nice, then someone is probably saying it for him. If he says something nasty, then probably he really did. So then, the scholars argue the author of Mark, whoever he was, the familiar names conventionally attached to each gospel come later, added the famous statement of a divine favor, descending directly from the heavens as they opened. But what does the voice say? In Mark, the voice says, "You are my son whom I love, with you I am well pleased," seeming to inform a Jesus who doesn't yet know that this is so. But some earlier versions of Luke had the voice quoting Psalm 2, "You are my son, today I have begotten you." Only in Matthew does it announce Jesus' divinity to the world as though it were an ancient, fixed agreement, not a new act. In Mark, for that matter, the two miraculous engines that push the story forward at the start and pull it toward heaven at the end, the virgin birth and the resurrection, make no appearance at all. The story begins with Jesus' adult baptism, with no hint of a special circumstance at his birth, and there is actually some grumbling by Jesus about his family, quote, "Only in his own town among his relatives and in his own house is a prophet without honor," end quote, he complains. It ends with a cry of desolation as he is executed and then an enigmatic and empty tomb. It's left to the Roman centurion to recognize him as the Son of God after he is dead, while the verses in Mark that show him risen were apparently added later. The intractable complexities of fact produce the inevitable ambiguities of faith. The more one knows, the less one knows. Was Jesus a carpenter, or even a carpenter's son? The Greek word tekton long meant taken to mean carpenter, could mean something closer to a stoneworker or a day laborer. One thinks of the similar shadings of a word like printer, which could refer to Ben Franklin or to his dog's body. If a carpenter, then presumably he was an artisan. If a stoneworker, then presumably he spent his early years as a laborer, schlepping from Nazareth to the grand Greco-Roman city of Sepphoris to help build its walls and perhaps visit its theater and agora. And what of the term Son of Man, which he uses again and again in Mark, mysteriously? The Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. As Diarmaid McCulloch points out in his new immensely ambitious and absorbing history, Christianity, the First 3,000 Years, the phrase which occurs in the Gospels virtually exclusively in the reported words of Jesus certainly isn't at all the same as the later Son of God, and may merely be Aramaic for folks like us. Belief remains a bounce, faith a leap. Still, the appetite for historical study of the New Testament remains a publishing constant and a popular craze. Book after book, this year 10 in 1 month alone, appears seeking the truth. Paul Johnson has A Sound Believer's Life, Jesus, A Biography from a Believer, while Paul Verhoeven, the director of Basic Instinct, has a new skeptical scholar's book, Jesus of Nazareth. Verhoeven turns out to be a member of the Jesus Seminar, a collection mostly of scholars devoted to reconstructing the historical Jesus, and much of what he has to say is shrewd and learned. An odd pull persists between box office and biblical study. A few years ago, another big action film director and producer, James Cameron, put himself at the center of a documentary called The Lost Tomb of Jesus. What the amateur reader wants, given the thickets of uncertainty that surround the garden, is not what the passionate polemicists want. Not so much a verdict on whether Jesus was nasty or nice, as a sense of what, if anything, was new in his preaching. Was the cult that changed the world a product of Paul's evangelism and imperial circumstance and the military embrace of one miracle mystery cult among many such around? Or was there really something new, something unheard of that can help explain the scale of what had happened later? Did the rise of Christendom take place because historical plates were moving with a poor martyred prophet caught between? Or did one small pebble of parable and preaching start the avalanche that ended the antique world? Ever since serious scholarly study of the Gospels began in the 19th century, its moods have ranged from the frankly skeptical, including a mythicist position that the story is entirely made up, to the credulous, with some archaeologists still holding that it is all pretty reliable and tombs and traces can be found if you study the text hard enough. The current scholarly tone is, judging from the new books, realist but pessimistic. While accepting a historical Jesus, the scholarship also tends to suggest that the search for him is a little like the search for the historical Sherlock Holmes. There were intellectually minded detectives around, and Conan Doyle had one in mind in the 1880s. But the really interesting bits, Watson, Irene Adler, Moriarty, and the Reichenbach Fall, were, even if they all had remote real-life sources, shaped by the needs of storytelling, not by traces of truth. Holmes dies because heroes must, and returns from the dead, like Jesus, because the audience demanded it. The view that the search for the historical Jesus is like the search for the historical Superman, that there's nothing there but a hopeful story and a girlfriend with an alliterative name, has by now been marginalized from the seminaries to the internet. The scholar Earl Doherty defends it on his website with grace and tenacity. The American scholar Bart Ehrman has been explaining the scholar's truths for more than a decade now in a series of sincere, quiet, and successful books. Ehrman is one of those best-selling authors like Richard Dawkins and Robert Ludlum and Peter Mayle who write the same book over and over. But the basic template is so good that the new version is always worth reading. In his latest installment, Jesus Interrupted, published by Harper One, Ehrman once again shares with his readers the not entirely good news he found a quarter century ago when, after a fundamentalist youth, he went to graduate school. That all the Gospels were written decades after Jesus' death, that all were written in Greek, which Jesus and the apostles didn't speak, and couldn't write if they could read and write at all, and that they were written as testaments of faith, not chronicles of biography, shaped to fit a prophecy rather than report a profile. The odd absences in Mark are matched by the unreal presences in the other Gospels. The beautiful nativity story in Luke, for instance, in which a Roman census forces the Holy Family to go back to its ancestral city of Bethlehem, is an obvious invention, since there was no empire-wide census at that moment, and no sane Roman bureaucrat would have dreamed of ordering people back to be counted in cities that their families had left hundreds of years before. The author of Luke, whoever he might have been, invented Bethlehem in order to put Jesus in David's city. James Tabor, a professor of religious studies, in his 2006 book, The Jesus Dynasty, takes surprisingly seriously the old Jewish idea that Jesus was known as the illegitimate son of a Roman soldier named Pantera, as well attested, a tradition as any, occurring in Jewish texts of the 2nd century, in which a Jesus ben Pantera makes several appearances, and the name is merely descriptive, not derogatory. Tabor has even found, however improbably, a tombstone in Germany for a Roman soldier from Syria-Palestine named Pantera. What seems a simple historical truth is that all the Gospels were written after the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple in the First Jewish-Roman War. In 70 AD, a catastrophe so large that it left the entire Jesus movement in a crisis that we can dimly imagine if we think of Jewish attitudes before and after the Holocaust. The scale of the tragedy leads us to see catastrophe as having been built into the circumstance. As L. Michael White's Scripting Jesus, the Gospels in Rewrite, published by Harper One, explains in daunting scholarly detail, even Mark, which, coming first, might seem to be the closest to the truth, was probably written in the ruins of the temple and spiritually shaped to its desolate moment. Mark's essential point, he explains, is about secrecy. Jesus keeps telling people to be quiet about his miracles and confides only to an inner circle of disciples. With the temple gone, White says, it was necessary to persuade people that the grotesque political failure of Jesus' messianism wasn't a real failure. Mark invents the idea that Jesus' secret was not that he was the Davidic Messiah, the Arthur-like returning king, but that he was someone even bigger, the Son of God, whose return would signify the end of time and the birth of the kingdom of God. The literary critic Frank Kermode, in The Genesis of Secrecy, a pioneering attempt to read Mark seriously as a poetic literature, made a similar point, though his is less historical than interpreted. Kermode considers Mark to be, as the French would say, a text that reads itself. The secret it contains is that its central figure is keeping a secret that we can never really get. It is an intentionally open-ended story, prematurely closed, a mystery without a single solution. Even if we make allowances for Mark's cryptic tracery, the human traits of his Jesus are evident: intelligence, short temper, and an ironic dueling wit. What seems new about Jesus is not his piety or divine detachment, but the humanity of his irritability and impatience. He's no Buddha. He gets annoyed at the stupidity of his followers, their inability to grasp an obvious point. "Do you have eyes but fail to see?" he asks the hapless disciples. The fine English actor Alec McGowan used to do a one-man show in which he recited Mark, complete. And his Jesus came alive instantly as a familiar human type. The Gandhi, Malcolm, Martin kind of charismatic leader of an oppressed people with a character that clicks into focus as you begin to dramatize it. He's verbally spry, and even a little shifty. He likes defiant, enigmatic paradoxes and pregnant parables that never quite close, perhaps by design. A story about a vineyard whose ungrateful husbandman kept killing the servants sent to them is an anti-establishment, even an anti-clerical story, but it isn't so obvious as to get him into trouble. The suspicious priests keep trying to catch him out in a declaration of anti-Roman sentiment. Is it lawful to give tribute to Caesar or not, they ask. That is, do you recognize Roman authority or don't you? He has a penny brought out, sees the picture of the emperor on it, and, shrugging, says to give to the state everything that rightly belongs to the state. The brilliance of that famous crack is that Jesus turns the question back on the questioner in mock innocence. Why, you give the king's things, and God, God's. Of course, this leaves open the real question, what is Caesar's and what is God's? It's a tautology designed to evade self-incrimination. Jesus' morality has a brash, sidewise indifference to conventional ideas of goodness. His pet style blends the epigrammatic with the enigmatic. When he makes that complaint about the prophet having no honor in his own hometown, or says exasperatedly that there is no point in lighting a candle unless you intend to put it in a candlestick, his voice carries a disdain for the props of piety that still feels startling. And so with the tale of the boy who wastes his inheritance but gets a feast from his father while his dutiful brother doesn't, or the one about the weeping whore who is worthier than her good, prim onlookers, or about the passionate Mary who is better than her hard-working sister Martha. There is a wild gaiety about Jesus' moral teachings that still leaps off the page. He is informal in a new way, too, that remains unusual among prophets. McCulloch points out that he continually addresses God as Abba, A-B-B-A, Father, or even Dad, and that the expression translated in the King James Version as a solemn, "Verily I say unto you," is actually a quirky Aramaic throat clearer like Dr. Johnson's, "Depend upon it, sir." Some of the sayings do have, in their contempt for material prosperity, the ring of Greek Cynic philosophy, but there is also something neither quite Greek nor quite Jewish about Jesus' morality that makes it fresh and strange even now. Is there a more miraculous scene in ancient literature than the one in John, where Jesus absent-mindedly writes on the ground while his fellow Jews try to entrap him into approving the stoning of an adulteress, only to ask, wide-eyed, if it wouldn't be a good idea for the honor of throwing the first stone to be given to the man in the mob who hasn't sinned himself? Is there a more compressed and charming religious exhortation than the one in the Gospel of Thomas, in which Jesus merrily recommends to his disciples, "Be passers-by"? Too much fussing about place and home and ritual, and even about where exactly you're going to live, is unnecessary. Be wanderers, Dharma bums. This social radicalism still shines through, not a programmatic radicalism of national revolution, but one of Kerouac-like Satori seeking on the road. And the social radicalism is highly social. The sharpest opposition in the Gospels, the scholar and former priest, John Dominic Crossan, points out in his illuminating books, The Historical Jesus, The Life of a Mediterranean Jewish Peasant, is the best known, is between John the Faster and Jesus the Feaster. Jesus eats and drinks with whores and highwaymen, turns water into wine, and finally, in one way or another, establishes a mystical union at a feast through its humble instruments of bread and wine. The table is his altar in every sense. Crossan, the co-founder of the Jesus Seminar, makes a persuasive case that Jesus' fressing was perhaps the most radical element in his life, that his table manners pointed the way to his heavenly morals. Crossan sees Jesus living within a Mediterranean Jewish peasant culture, a culture of clan and cohort, in which who eats with whom defines who stands where and why. So the way Jesus repeatedly violates the rules on eating, on commensality, would have shocked his contemporaries. He dines with people of a different social rank, which would have shocked most Romans, and with people of different tribal allegiance, which would have shocked most Jews. The most forceful of his sayings, still shocking to any pious Jew or Muslim, is, "What goes into a man's mouth does not make him unclean, but what comes out of his mouth, that is what makes him unclean." Jesus isn't a hedonist or an Epicurean, but he clearly isn't an ascetic either. He feeds the multitudes rather than instructing them how to go without. He's interested in saving people living normal lives, buying and selling what they can, rather than in retreating into the company of those who have already arrived at a moral conclusion about themselves. To a modern reader, the relaxed egalitarianism of the open road and the open table can seem undermined by the other part of Jesus' message, a violent and even vengeful prediction of a final judgment and a large-scale damnation. In Mark, Jesus is both a fierce apocalyptic prophet who is preaching the death of the world, he says categorically that the end is near, and a wise philosophical teacher who professes love for his neighbor and supplies advice for living. If the end is near, why give so much sage counsel? If human life is nearly over, why preach in such detail to the right way to live? One argument is that a later, perhaps unpersonified body of Hellenized wisdom literature was tacked on to an earlier account of a Jewish messianic prophet. Since both kinds of literature, apocalyptic hysterics and Stoic sayings, can be found all over the period, perhaps they were merely wrenched together. And yet a single figure who projects two personae at the same time or in close sequence, one dark and one dreamy, is a commonplace among charismatic prophets. That's what a charismatic prophet is. Someone whose aura of personal conviction manages to reconcile a hard doctrine with a humane manner. The leaders of the African American community before the Civil Rights era, for instance, had to be both prophets and political agitators to an oppressed and persecuted people in a way not unlike that of the real Jesus and all the other forgotten zealots and rabbis whom the first century Jewish historian Josephus names and sighs over. They, too, tended to oscillate between the comforting and the catastrophic. Malcolm X was the very model of a modern apocalyptic prophet politician, unambiguously preaching violence and a doctrine of millennial revenge, all fueled by a set of cult beliefs, a hovering UFO, a strange racial myth. But Malcolm was also a community builder, a moral reformer, genuinely distraught over the sexual sins of his leader, who refused to carry weapons, and who ended within the constraints of his faith as some kind of universalist. When he was martyred, he was called a prophet of hate. Within 3 decades of his death, about the time that separates the Gospels from Jesus, he could be the cover subject of a liberal humanist magazine like this one. One can even see how martyrdom and beatification draws out more personal detail almost perfectly on schedule. Alex Haley, Malcolm's Paul, is long on doctrine and short on details. 30 years on, Spike Lee, his Mark, has a full role for a wife and children and a universalist message that manages to blend Malcolm into Mandela. As if to prove this point, just the other week came news of suppressed chapters of Haley's autobiography, which, according to Malcolm's daughter, showed too much of my father's humanity. As the Baha'i knew, we always tear our gods to bits and eat the bits we like. Still, a real unchangeable difference does exist between what might be called storytelling truths and statement-making truths. Between what makes credible, if sweeping, sense in a story and what's required for a close-knit metaphysical argument. Certain kinds of truths are convincing only in narrative. The idea, for instance, that the ring of power should be given to 2 undersized amateurs to throw into a volcano at the very center of the enemy's camp makes sound and sober sense, of a kind in Tolkien. But you would never expect to find it as a premise at the Middle Earth Military Academy. Anyone watching Hamlet will find his behavior completely understandable. Okay, I buy it. He's toying with his uncle, though any critic thinking about it afterward will reflect that this behavior is a little bit nuts. In Mark, Jesus' divinity unfolds without quite making sense intellectually and without ever needing to. It has a hypnotic flow of dramatic movement. The story is one of self-discovery. He doesn't know who he is, and then he begins to think he does, and then he doubts, and in a pain and glory he dies and is known. The story works, but as a proposition under scrutiny, it makes intolerable demands on logic. If Jesus is truly one with God, in what sense could he suffer doubt, fear, exasperation, pain, horror, and so on? So we get the Jesus rendered in the book of John, who doesn't. But if he doesn't suffer doubt, fear, exasperation, pain, and horror, in what sense is his death a sacrifice rather than just a theatrical enactment? A lamb whose throat is not cut and does not bleed is not really much of an offering. None of this is very troubling if one has a pagan idea of divinity. The Son of God might then be half human and half divine, suffering and triumphing, and working out his heroic destiny in the half-mortal way of Hercules, for instance. But that's ruled out by the full weight of the Jewish idea of divinity, omnipresent and omniscient, knowing all and seeing all. If God he was, not some Hinduish avatar or offspring of God, but actually one with God, then God once was born and had dirty diapers and took naps. The longer you think about it, the more astounding or absurd it becomes. To be really believed at all, it can only be told again. So, the long history of the early church councils that tried to make the tales into a theology is, in a way, a history of coming out of the movie confused and turning to someone else to ask what just happened. The effort to seal off the inspiration from the intolerance, nice Jesus from nasty Jesus, is very old. Jefferson compiled his own New Testament with the ethical teachings left in and the miracles and damnations left out, and that familiar, outraged sense of the ugly duplicity of the Christian heritage is at the heart of Philip Pullman's new plaint against it, The Good Man Jesus and the Scoundrel Christ, published by Canongate, in which the two aspects are neatly divided into twins born by Mary. The wise Jesus is brother to the shrewd Christ. One leads to the nice Jewish boy, the other to Paul's scary, punitive God. Pullman, a writer of great skill and feeling, as he has shown in his magical children's fantasies, feels the betrayal of Jesus by his brother Christ as a fundamental betrayal of humanity. He wants us to forget Christ and return to Jesus alone, to surrender miracles for morals. Pullman's book, however, is not narrowly polemical. He also retells the parables and acts with a lucid simplicity that strips away the Pauline barnacles. His real achievement is to translate Jesus' sayings into simple, almost childlike English that would seem to have much of the sound we are told is present in the artless original Greek. Quote, "Those who make peace between enemies, those who solve bitter disputes, they will be blessed. But beware and remember what I tell you, that there are some who will be cursed, who will never inherit the kingdom of God." Beyond all the words, however, we still hear that cry. The passion is still the point. In Mark, Jesus' arrest and execution feels persuasively less preordained and willed than accidental and horrific. Jesus seems to have an intimation of the circumstance he has found himself in, leading a rebellion against Rome that is not really a rebellion, yet doesn't really leave any possibility of retreat. And some corner of his soul wants no part of it. Abba, Father, everything is possible for you. Take away this cup from me. In the long history of human cruelty, crucifixion, practiced as a mass punishment by the Romans, was uniquely horrible. Verhoeven, citing Croson, offers an opening scene for a Jesus biopic which neatly underlines his point. He imagines a man being nailed to a cross, cries of agony, two companion crosses in view, and then we crane out to see 200 crosses and 200 victims. We are at the beginning of the story, the mass execution of Jewish rebels in 4 BC, not the end. This was the Roman death waiting for rebels from the outset, and Jesus knew it. Jesus' cry of desolation, my God, why have you forsaken me? Pierces us even now from the pages of Mark, across all the centuries and church comforts. The shock and pity of failure still resonates. One thing, at least, the cry assures, that Jesus' faith begins with a failure of faith. His Father let him down, and the promise wasn't kept. Some who are standing here will not taste death before they see the kingdom of God, Jesus announced. But none of them did. Jesus and Paul following him says unambiguously that whatever is coming soon, that the end is very, very near. It wasn't, and the whole of what follows is built on an apology for what went wrong. The seemingly modern waiver, well, I know he said that, but he didn't really mean it quite the way it sounded, is built right into the foundation of the cult. The sublime symbolic turn, or the retreat to metaphor if you prefer, begins with the first words of the faith. If the kingdom of God proved elusive, he must have meant that the kingdom of God was inside, or outside, or above, or yet to come, anything other than what the words seem so plainly to have meant. The argument is the reality, and the absence of certainty, the certainty. Authority and fear can circumscribe the argument or congeal it, but can't end it. In the beginning was the Word, in the beginning and in the middle, and right there at the close, Word without end. Amen. The impulse of orthodoxy has always been to suppress the wrangling as a sign of weakness. The impulse of more modern theology is to embrace it as a sign of life. The deeper question is whether the uncertainty at the center mimics the plurality of possibilities essential to liberal debate, as the more open-minded theologians like to believe, or is it an antique mystery in a story open only as the tomb is open, with a mystery left inside, never to be entirely explored or explained? With so many words over so long a time, perhaps passerbys can still hear tones inaudible to the more passionate participants. Somebody seems to have hoped so once. Well, that's it for today's New Yorker. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.